Carl Nielsen's Violin Concerto of 1911. Vilde Frang was the soloist and Eivind Guldberg Jensen conducted the Danish National Symphony Orchestra. And next week we've Bartok's first violin concerto, and in a fortnight I'll be returning with Glazunov's violin concerto. Well, that's all for today. Rob's in the driving seat next Sunday. I hope you've enjoyed my selection of music this morning, and do have a music-filled week ahead, not hard, with the proms still in full swing.
Sunday Morning with James Jolly was a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production today by Neil Miners.
The BBC asks thousands of questions every day. What are the tingles we feel when listening to music? Can life exist above the clouds? And why do we think Elgar's music sounds English? But what if we want to know more? BBC I Wonder asks intriguing questions and reveals thought-provoking answers. As one question is answered, another is raised. The discoveries are endless. BBC I Wonder. Go to bbc.co.uk/iwonder.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. Time now for Private Passions. Michael Buckley's guest today is the novelist and poet Sophie Hannah.
The ghost of Poirot with his wax moustache hovers over my studio today because there's a new Poirot mystery appearing, but not by Agatha Christie, who rather got sick of her detective and killed him off, but by my guest today, Sophie Hannah. She was appointed by the Christie estate to invent a new adventure for the dapper Belgian detective, and she's called it The Monogram Murders. It's published this week. Sophie Hannah's an interesting choice to follow Agatha Christie, a prize-winning poet whose work is studied in schools and universities, and the author of 9 dark psychological thrillers. Alongside the thrillers, one a year, she's edited an anthology of poems about sex, composed love lyrics for contemporary composers, has been writer-in-residence at Trinity College, Cambridge, so no shortage of the little grey cells. Sophie, is it a bit of a daunting challenge to take on Agatha Christie?
Yes, it's daunting, but daunting in a good and useful way. I think if I'd tried to write a Poirot novel and I hadn't been slightly scared and slightly thinking, yikes, will I actually be able to do this? Can anyone live up to Agatha Christie and step into her shoes? If I hadn't had all that fear, I probably would have written a far worse book.
Have you always liked her writing?
Yes, liked is an understatement. I've always been absolutely obsessed with Agatha Christie, a real fan. From the age of 12, when my dad first bought me a second-hand copy of The Body in the Library, and I was hooked from that day. By the time I was 14, I'd read every word Agatha had ever published. And I think she was a huge influence on my own writing.
Is it the element of surprise, the sting in the tail, that
It's the fact that she never started with anything mundane. She would always start with a plot hook that was so almost impossible to believe it was happening, and that would make the reader think, no, this surely cannot be the case, and yet here it is unfolding. And I just fell in love with crime fiction thanks to her work, really.
Agatha Christie was, of course, a keen musician. In fact, I think she trained to be a classical pianist. And you too, Sophie, enjoy singing along with music. Indeed, you are a karaoke star.
Yes, the more lowbrow end of the music spectrum there. Yes, I used to be a karaoke addict. I once won £65 in a karaoke competition for my rendition of Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush. And it was this long-running karaoke competition in our local pub. And we'd all been told that one of the judges was somebody from the music industry. The other two were the landlady of the pub and the compere of, you know, the guy who owned the karaoke machine. But we were very excited about Gary, who was the representative of the music industry. We thought he was a real, you know, impresario who could launch us to stardom if we were lucky. And then a few weeks after the competition was finished, somebody saw Gary wearing a pizza delivery outfit and carrying a suspicious rectangular cardboard box, and it turned out that Gary worked for Snappy Tomato in Levenshulme. So, I mean, I don't know whether he worked in the music industry as well, but I think we may have been fibbed to somewhat.
You missed your stop on the tube getting here today, Sophie, because you were photographing a dog which took your fancy. Tell me about this. It was one of those unusual ones, Bedlington, wasn't it?
Yes, well, I've recently become very, very keen on dogs. In January, we got our first ever dog, which is a Welsh terrier called Brewster. And I'm writing a psychological thriller at the moment, which prominently features a Bedlington terrier, because I didn't want to write about the same breed that I've got. That looks a bit too nepotistic. And then I was on the tube today and I suddenly saw a Bedlington terrier three seats down that looked exactly like the one in my book. And these kind of things sometimes happen. You think, this is a weird coincidence. So I thought, well, I have to get a photo of this Bedlington. And my tube stop was coming up any minute, so I had to stay on for an extra stop to photograph the dog.
Look, anybody will tell you, if you put a dog before me, you're my good books. Your first choice of music is from that wonderful Schumann cycle. Indeed, we're going through a kind of anthology of song in this programme, which is very interesting. We'll come on to that. But this is A Woman's Love and Life. It doesn't end terribly well, this cycle, does it?
No, but this is the first song, and it's my favourite in the cycle. I don't think it's my favourite because it's the happiest, most sort of optimistic one. I just love the tune. And when I first heard it, I just listened to the lyrics without knowing what they were saying. And I fell in love with the tune, really, and it just seems to me to be the perfect tune for a really romantic love song.
Since I saw him, I believe myself to be blind. I see him alone. His image floats before me.
Sei dich hin gesehen, glaub ich blind zu sein, wo ich hin nur blicke.
The opening song from Schumann's song cycle, Frauen Liebe und Leben, A Woman's Life and Love. Graham Johnson accompanying Felicity Lott. I mentioned earlier, Sophie Hannah, that you've been involved in writing libretti for composers who are working now. And in fact, I think two contemporary composers have asked you to give them poems for their own versions of that Schumann song cycle. And I thought it'd be good to hear music from one of those song cycles. So this is, in a sense, our choice rather than yours. The composer is Gabriel Jackson. But perhaps before we hear the song, you could read the words for us.
View. I am not lonely. I pretend that I am here alone. I do not see your shuttered face or hear your monotone, but stare instead at roads and fields and bridges and the sky, and feel the sun's rays on my face. However hard you try to substitute your view for mine, I see the things I see, and am no longer here with you, though you are here with me.
Gabriel Jackson's setting of View. Susan Legg singing words by my guest today, Sophie Hannah, and the pianist was Anne Martin Davis. You've written a great deal about love, Sophie, and the very extreme states of mind that falling in love can bring.
Most of what I write, whether it's poetry or fiction, is about, well, usually love gone wrong, unrequited love, forbidden love, love that starts well and ends disastrously, love that inspires people to commit murder in the crime novels. And I didn't actually realise until I looked at all the pieces of music I'd chosen that that was a very, very dominant theme. It was one of those things where I thought, huh, OK, I've just learnt something about myself.
You come across as very bubbly and, you know, effervescent in some ways, and yet there clearly is this very dark streak that you like to mine.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the bubbliness is just a veneer to hide the inner torment. it's kind of impolite to sort of be grumpy and miserable in front of people. I'm a very happy and optimistic person, but I'm also fascinated by and prone to sort of dark, brooding psychology. I've always been sort of attuned to the sort of less happy and less healthy ways relationships can work. It's always very obvious if you're in a relationship or if you're witnessing a relationship from outside and there's something very, very wrong. And those kind of relationships are so common, you know, they don't always end up on the news and result in murder. But we probably all know people where when we leave their house, we turn to our person we're with and say, there's something funny going on in that relationship.
Yes, and unfortunately, bad news tends to be more interesting than good news, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, certainly in my poetry writing, a lot of the sort of relationship poems are about relationships gone wrong and the sort of sad and difficult side of relationships.
Well, the lyrics of your next choice are rather appropriate, having just said that love is a rebellious bird that nobody can tame. What do you love about this?
I love the whole idea of Carmen, as you know, the idea of this femme fatale who can make any man fall in love with her, and just the way it's taken for granted that love can be quite destructive. You know, the refrain line is, if I love you, that's the end of you.
And you've chosen Maria Callas singing the role of the gypsy Carmen.
Aujourd'hui, si certain.
Maria Callas singing the Habanera from Bizet's Carmen. Georges Prêt was conducting the Paris National Opera Orchestra and Chorus.
I actually remembered while we were listening to that song that one of the other reasons I chose that particular song is that the book I'm writing at the moment, which is not out till next year, Carmen and Bizet feature rather crucially in the plot. And in fact, Bizet saves someone's life. I know that sounds improbable. The idea of him and the mention of him saves someone's life at a particular point. I can't really give any more away, but so I've been listening to Carmen a lot while writing the book.
Is this the one with the Bedlington in it?
It is, yes. It's called A Game for All the
Family. It's getting
family.
More interesting.
A Bedlington Terrier and some Bizet, yes.
But you know, there's another rather tragic story to all of this, which is that Bizet actually died before knowing that the opera he'd written, Carmen, was to be one of the most popular operas
really?
In the world.
I didn't
yes,
know
no.
That.
So he didn't live to know how successful it was.
No, oh dear.
Your poetry has a kind of teasing and often amusing side to it. One thinks of Lewis Carroll, and so I wonder whether that rather made you think of our next choice, rather your next choice, the Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yes. One of the things that I'm fascinated by is the ways in which people behave in incredibly dysfunctional and just crazy ways. You know, people get up to all kinds of absolutely bonkers behaviours, and more often than not, they justify it to themselves and create a sort of moral worldview where the totally illogical thing they're doing is the one and only universal truth, and they are absolutely right. And I'm quite interested in the sort of the ways in which people hypocritically notice all the good things they do while noticing all the bad things other people do.
So life is stranger than fiction, in fact.
Yes, and certainly people in real life are stranger than fictional characters. There's a kind of urge on the part of readers and writers and publishers to tidy people up a bit before you put them in a book. Make them a bit more sympathetic, a bit more, you know, plucky, good sort, battling away against the odds. And I think in real life, most people are kind of thinly veiled bundles of dysfunction, entertaining ones, best case scenario, but nevertheless, really, really odd. So what I love about this song from the Mikado is the way it puts forward this crazy system whereby, you know, somebody has to be the Lord High Executioner, and anyone who flirts with anyone who they're not married to has to be beheaded, but then they realise they would have to behead everyone. And instead of at this point realising how stupid it all is, they come up with a cunning plan that will make it work. And I like it because it reminds me of how absurd human beings are. I think that's something that's quite important to remember at all times.
Great Mikado, virtuous man, when he to rule our land began, resolved to try a plan whereby young men might best be steadied. So he decreed in words succinct that all who flirted, leered or winked, unless connubially linked, should forthwith be beheaded, 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 should forthwith be beheaded. I expect that you'll agree that he was right to so decree, and I am right, and you were right, and all is right as right can be.
And you were right, and we are right, and all is right as right as right can be.
And all is right as right can be. Stern decree, you'll understand, caused great dismay throughout the land, for young and old and shy and bold were equally affected. The youth who winked a roving eye or breathed a non-connubial sigh was thereupon condemned to die. He usually objected, objected, objected. He usually objected. Allow, as I expect, that he was right to so object, and I am right, and you are right, and everything is quite correct.
And you are right, and we are right, and everything is quite correct.
And everything is quite correct.
magistrate let out on bail a convict from the county jail, whose head was next on some pretext condemned to be mown off, and made him headsman, for we said, who's next to be decapitated cannot cut off another's head until he's cut his own off, his own off, his own off, until he's cut his own off. We are right, I think you'll say, to argue in this kind of way. And I am right, and you are right, and all is right, and all is right, and all is right,
and you are right, and we are right, and all is right, and all is right.
And I am right, and you are right, and all is right.
Our Great Mikado, sung by John Cameron, from, of course, Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado, Malcolm Sargent conducting the Glyndebourne Festival Chorus and the Pro Arte Orchestra. You began writing psychological thrillers, detective stories, with something of a nightmare undertow, the kind of anxiety that I think wakes people at night. And your very first, Sophie Hannah, called Little Face, has an opening scenario that I don't think many readers will forget. It's the kind of scenario that haunts anyone who's ever looked after a small baby.
Yes, the heroine, Alice, has been home with her new baby for 2 weeks, and she goes out for the first time, leaving the baby at home in the care of her husband. When she gets back to the house a couple of hours later, there is a baby there, and it is wearing her daughter's baby grow and asleep in her daughter's cot, but Alice swears blind that the baby in the house is not her daughter, and that while she's been out, somebody must have swapped her baby for another baby.
And had they?
Well, I can't tell you that, because that ruins the entire plot.
No. You had this idea just after you'd had your own baby.
Yes, well, I had written crime novels before that were never published, and they were sort of a bit naive and inexperienced, and various editors said to me, you know, try again when you've had a bit more life experience. And having had a baby for sort of a few hours, I thought, right, now I've suffered enough to write crime fiction. And shortly after my daughter was born, there was an incident in the hospital where the midwife appeared at my bedside with a baby that I was pretty sure was mine, and she had to say, no, your baby's over there in a cot. This is someone else's baby. And I became quite gripped and fascinated by the idea that you can be somebody's closest relative in the whole world and not have a clue what they look like. And so that was really where the idea came from.
Our next music, Sophie, is seasonal. We normally hear it at Christmas. But you've chosen it because it actually inspired a recent ghost story.
Yes. Last autumn, I published a novella, which is my first ever supernatural, spooky publication. It's called The Orphan Choir. And it was partly inspired by the fact that my daughter belongs to a Cambridge College choir. And they sing in a college chapel and they wear robes. And it's all very atmospheric and historical seeming and spooky, you know. And the choir were singing a Christmas concert and they started singing O Come, Emmanuel. And I had never heard that hymn before. And as soon as they started to sing it, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up and I just thought, wow, this is the soundtrack for my supernatural novel.
Rejoice, rejoice.
choir of King's College, Cambridge, singing part of the carol which so haunts my guest today, Sophie Hannah, O Come, Emmanuel. David Wilcox was conducting his own arrangement, and you can look up all the details of today's recordings on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Would you say your imagination has a gothic element to it, Sophie Hannah?
I wouldn't have personally said that, but I think I must be wrong not to say it because I keep reading in reviews and articles and places where people are talking about my writing that I am gothic. And recently, in fact, The Spectator said that I was ordinary gothic or contemporary gothic. So I'm not sure I fully understand what gothic means. I don't always write about people who live in large cobwebby houses in the middle of nowhere, although I do occasionally write about people who do. But yeah, it's certainly something that's been said about my writing.
Well, I think possibly it is true that you write interestingly about the criminals, as it were, because you identify with them in some way.
Yes, I mean, I certainly don't write books in which the murderers are evil bad guys. The kind of crimes I'm interested in writing about are the crimes where somebody who, because of forces beyond their control or something unexpected happening or several different things coming together in an unfortunate way at a particular time, they're driven to do something that they wouldn't normally do through misery or desperation, or they're in terrible pain themselves, so they're lashing out. And I prefer to write about those kind of murders because then the murderer isn't just a caricature of evil. The murderer is somebody who any of us could easily turn into in the wrong circumstances.
A singer now, you say you can't live without Sophie, Emmylou Harris.
Yes, if I was told that I had to go and live in one room forever and could only take one musical artist's work with me, Emmylou Harris is the person I would take. She's my all-time favourite singer-songwriter.
Mean Willie played in a country band 7 long years together, playing those one-night stands. Used to say the booze in the bars were gonna wear him out. Oh Lord, the songs he wrote tear your heart right out. He traveled north and blue from the Great Lakes to Montreal, hitting all the honky-tonks, bet we played them all. Willie played to ease his soul and drank to ease his mind, and I never understood how he played so good while drinking himself out blind. And you wouldn't think the man so weak could be so strong. Take a crowd around.
Me and Willie, Emmylou Harris, with a song about a love affair with someone talented but self-destructive. One of the interesting things about this programme, I find, is that it defies the convention and the conventions that we're all very familiar with on Radio 3, that, for example, a song recital that might have Schubert and Schumann in wouldn't separate them by Emmylou Harris. but I like that kind of serendipitous approach to music, because we don't get it just through straight concert programming. And indeed, we're going to move on to a Schubert song from Die Schöne Müllerin. And he was 26 when he wrote this setting of poems by Wilhelm Müller. And again, I'm afraid it is a love affair with a tragic ending.
Yes, I mean, actually, it's quite funny. This particular song, I first fell in love with it when I was about 9. I was either 8 or 9. And I was in love, insofar as one can be when one is 9, with a boy in my class at primary school called David Kershaw. And I was completely obsessed with David Kershaw, to the point where my parents had been called into school by the teacher, who said, "We're very worried about Sophie. She spends all day chasing David Kershaw around the classroom." And my parents said, "Well, hold on a minute. Can she add up and read?" And the teacher said yes, and they said, "Well, we don't mind if she chases David Kershaw around the classroom."
How did David Kershaw feel about it?
No, he wished I would not chase him around the classroom. He was he'd made it very clear that he wanted to, you know, go out into the playground with the boys and throw conkers at people. He wasn't interested in a love affair at the age of 9. But anyway, his family had some kind of German connection, and at the same time, my mum just happened to have bought Die Schöne Müllerin, and she was playing this particular song, and she said, "Oh, you know, isn't this wonderful, this German love song?" And I thought, oh, a German love song. This is the perfect song to symbolise my doomed love for David Kershaw.
Ich grüb es gern in jeden Kieselstein. Ich möchte säen auf jedes frische Beet mit Kressensamen, der es schnell verrät. Auf jeden weißen Zettel möchte ich schreiben: Dein ist mein Herz, dein ist mein Herz, und sei es ewig, ewig bleibe. Wir ziehen einen jungen Star, bis das er spricht, die Worte rein und klar, bis er sie spricht mit meines Mundes Klang, mit meines Herzens vollem heißem Drang. Dann sänge hell ich ihre Fensterscheiben. Dein ist mein Herz, dein ist mein Herz, und so seh ich, ewig durch den Regen ein, und leuchtet es aus jedem Blumenstern, trüg es der Duft zu mir von nah und fern. Ihr Vogel könnt ihr nicht aus Fehler treiben. Dein ist mein Herz, dein ist mein Herz, und so es ewig, ewig bleiben. Müsste in meinen Augen stehen, auf meinen Wangen müsste man's brennen sehen, zu lesen wär's auf meinem stummen Mund, ein jeder Atemzug gibt's Land ihr kund, und sie merkt nichts von allem Banden treiben. Dein ist mein Herz, dein ist mein Herz, wo soll es ewig, ewig bleiben?
Impatience from Schubert's song cycle Die Schöne Müllerin. We heard Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau with Gerald Moore playing the piano. And that was the actual recording, I think, that you heard all those years ago. And should David Kershaw be listening, we sent him our warmest sympathies.
Yes, and also we could tell him he needn't worry, because since then I've had romantic obsessions with at least 1,400 other people, so he's thoroughly in the clear by now.
Moving on to our next music, Sophie, it might be interesting to set it against that song of romantic infatuation, because it's another long song, but a bitter song of revenge and love turned actually to hatred.
It's saying what a tragedy it is when love that was that amazing at first goes so badly wrong in the end.
You hurt the ones that I love best and cover up the truth with lies. One day you'll be in the ditch, flies buzzing round your eyes. I'm rather interested, as a poet, Sophie Hannah, what you make of Dylan's gifts and the way they combine the songwriter and the words.
I think he's definitely one of the biggest geniuses that's ever lived. And yeah, the lyrics are just amazing. And that bit you just quoted is one of my favourite bits from Idiot Wind. And actually, you know, if you're really angry with someone and you sing Idiot Wind, it makes you feel better almost straight away.
Someone's got it in for me. They're planting stories in the press. Whoever it is, I wish they cut it out quick. But when they will, I can only guess. They say I shot a man named Gray and took his wife to Italy. She inherited $1 million, and when she died, it came to me. If I'm lucky, people see me all the time, and they just can't remember how to act. Their minds are filled with big ideas, images, and distorted facts. Even you, yesterday, you had to ask me where it was at. I couldn't believe after all.
Bob Dylan singing Idiot Wind from his 1975 album Blood on the Tracks. It's unusual, isn't it, in a love song to find quite such strong sort of bitterness. You don't often hear it, really.
No, you don't. And that's why I think Dylan is so great at that particular kind of song. What I love about Idiot Wind is that although it reveals none of the specifics of the relationship, because it sort of surrealises everything that's happened and there's lots of attitude but not a lot of specific detail, you totally get a sense of what that relationship felt like. And I think the anger gives it a special power. I love Bob Dylan's angry songs better than any of his other songs.
Well, next in what's turning into something of an anthology of your favourite love songs, Sophie Hannah, we've got Edith Piaf, and there's perhaps almost inevitably a rather dark side to this.
This is such a sad story. It is my favourite Edith Piaf song, and it's also the one that has the most sort of miserable romantic story. Her lover, Marcel Cerdain, was due to fly to wherever she was to meet her and spend time with her. And she persuaded him to catch an earlier flight. He was married and had a family. She persuaded him to sort of escape a night early, and his plane crashed. And he was the great love of her life. I don't know whether this song was actually written with him in mind, but certainly when she sang it the next night after she'd heard that he'd died. And I think she obviously was thinking of him when she sang it. And it just makes it so much more powerful to know that story behind it.
Le ciel bleu sur nous peut s'effondrer et la terre peut bien s'écrouler. De ma bonne, si tu m'aimes, je me fous du monde entier. Tant que l'amour inondera mes matins, tant que mon corps frémira sous tes mains. De ma porte, les problèmes, mon amour, puisque tu me jusqu'au bout du monde, je me ferai teindre en blonde si tu me le demandais. J'irai décrocher la lune, j'irai voler la fortune si tu me le demandais. Je renierai ma patrie, je renierai mes amis si tu me le demandais. On peut bien rire de moi, je ferai n'importe quoi si tu me le demandais. Un jour, la vie t'arrache à moi. Si tu meurs, que tu sois loin de moi. De ma part, si tu m'aimes, par moi je mourrai aussi. Nous aurons dans le bleu de toute l'immensité, dans le ciel, plus de problèmes, mon amour, crois-tu qu'on se... Ce qui
There's a feeling of desperation in that. Actually, Piaf did sing it just after he died, but she wrote it 6 weeks earlier and had already sung it, I think.
Yeah.
So it has a kind of terrible double resonance, doesn't it?
Yes. Although you can take some comfort from the last line, God reunites those who love each other. I like to take that as a sign that she and Marcel Cerdan will meet again at some point.
Do you believe in that?
Yes, definitely. I believe in anything that's happy rather than miserable. If you present me with a plausible, nice scenario, and I'm very willing to believe it.
So, Edith Piaf's Hymn to Love, a recording from 1950. In your new Agatha Christie novel, is Poirot going to have a secret life?
Poirot is very much the same Poirot that Agatha Christie created. So anything that she didn't do with him in the course of the however many books she wrote about him, I certainly didn't feel it was my place to add. You know, I wouldn't give him a secret life, sort of, I don't know, being a roller skating champion or...
No, but he did have a love affair, I think, didn't he, with a Russian countess at one point?
There's a reference to it, yes, in one of the Christie books, but the sort of very noticeable thing about Poirot is that although he's very keen on helping people who love each other to get together, he never has any romantic action of his own going on, and you certainly get the sense that anything like that he ever had is sort of in the past. I felt that my job was just to bring him a really baffling and intriguing case to solve, and certainly not to try and introduce any sort of love life for him. I don't think he'd want one, you know.
I think all that waxing would become very tedious for a partner, don't you?
Well, I mean, imagine if he fell in love with someone who wasn't fussy about food and said, you know, let's just grab a sandwich anywhere. He wouldn't like that at all. So, no, I think that, you know, it was very important to me to keep Poirot in every way the same.
Purcell, finally, and this is about love, but your love of England, Sophie, and Cambridge, where you now live.
Yes, so actually Fairest Isle was the music that I had playing at my wedding, and it does remind me of Cambridge. My husband and I first moved to Cambridge before we were married in 1997, and we both fell in love with the place. We lived on Newton Road, in a house called Dryden House. So, you know, all the famous people who'd ever been in Cambridge had their names all over houses and roads. Then we had to leave Cambridge, and for 11 years we lived in Yorkshire because of my husband's work. But he then gave up his job in 2008, and we didn't have to live anywhere in particular because, you know, we were both working from home at that point. And we just thought, we've got to go back to Cambridge. We love it so much. And because the lyrics of Fairest Isle are by Dryden, and we used to live in Dryden House, Fairest Isle was always our sort of Cambridge song. You know, it reminded us of Cambridge. And then when we decided to get married, we had it at our wedding.
And does Brewster, your Welsh terrier, enjoy Purcell?
He loves Welsh music, according to my husband. I'm not sure this is... been scientifically proven, but my husband claims that whenever he puts on Welsh folk music, Brewster perks up. I'm not sure whether he's had any Purcell played.
Well, he probably hears you singing it to your iPod as you walk him. Let's imagine you walking along singing to Purcell on your headphones at the top of your voice. And on that note, we thank you very much, Sophie Hannah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Véronique Jeans singing Fairest Isle from Purcell's King Arthur with William Christie and Lézard Florissant. Michael Barclay's guest in Private Passions was the writer Sophie Hannah. The programme was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3 and the producer was Elizabeth Burke. Next week, at the same time, Michael's guest is the choreographer Gillian Lynn.
The world's best orchestras are live at the BBC Proms. Franz Welser-Mürst brings one of America's finest ensembles, the Cleveland Orchestra, to the Royal Albert Hall for two nights of music by Brahms, alongside new works by Jörg Wiedmann. This evening, they play Brahms's Academic Festival Overture alongside his First Symphony. And tomorrow, Brahms's Second Symphony is paired with his Tragic Overture. Join the audience in the Royal Albert Hall for two nights with Franz Welser-Mürst and the Cleveland Orchestra. This evening at 7:30 and tomorrow at 7, live here on BBC Radio 3.
And before tonight's live prom, we'll be welcoming some more visitors from overseas to the Royal Albert Hall, making their BBC Proms debut, the Qatar Philharmonic Orchestra. And their concert is this afternoon at 3:30. Hello, I'm John Shea with you this Sunday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. Before that prom at 3:30, we've the early music show with Lucy Skeeping at 2:15. And before that, in a couple of minutes, another chance to hear last Monday's BBC Proms chamber music, a recital by the pianist Benjamin Grosvenor. Now, with the time at just after 1 o'clock, here's Vaughan Savage with the latest BBC news.
Scotland's First Minister, Alex Salmond, has accused the British government of panicky last-minute measures after the Chancellor, George Osborne, said Scotland would be given greater autonomy if voters decided to stay in the United Kingdom. An opinion poll by YouGov for the Sunday Times indicated a narrow majority in favour of leaving the UK. It's the first time a mainstream poll has put the Yes campaign ahead. Another poll by Panel Base for the Yes Scotland campaign gives a narrow lead to the no vote. There are fears that the ceasefire in Ukraine is near to collapse following fresh shelling near Donetsk airport. The building is being defended by Ukrainian government troops. Last night, rebels bombarded Ukrainian government positions in the port city of Mariupol. Local officials say one woman was killed and three people were wounded. American fighter jets have carried out airstrikes against Islamic State militants near the Haditha Dam, northwest of Baghdad. It's the first time the US has extended its air campaign to targets in Al-Anbar province in western Iraq. The radical Muslim cleric Abu Qatada has condemned the beheading of two American journalists by Islamic State militants. He said reporters were messengers of truth and should not be killed, as that's what Prophet Muhammad taught. He was speaking at the start of his terrorism trial in Jordan. He was extradited from Britain last year after a long legal battle. The Labour MP Jim Dobbin has died at the age of 73. Mr Dobbin was a microbiologist for three decades before securing the Heywood and Middleton seat in 1997. Mo Farah has become the first British man to win the Great North Run for 29 years. The double Olympic champion completed the half-marathon course in a personal best time of 1 hour. The weather, dry, fine and sunny for most, but there will be rain across northeast Scotland. Highs of 22 degrees in London and 19 in Cardiff. The BBC News and weather at 3 minutes past one.
From Vaughan Savage. The origins of klezmer, the music of the Ashkenazi Jews of Eastern Europe. That's the subject of the early music show. Lucy Skeeping presents that at 2:15. This afternoon. Before that, here on Radio 3, another chance to hear last Monday's Proms chamber music recital. It's presented by Petroc Trelawney.
Hello, welcome. Today, a piano stands centre stage here at Cadogan Hall, ready for a recital by Benjamin Grosvenor. This former Radio 3 New Generation artist made his Proms debut playing Liszt's second piano concerto on the first night of the 2011 season. Since then, the young pianist from Essex has become something of a veteran at this great festival. Today marks his fifth appearance. Judith Weir's Daybreak, Shadows Flee is the 20th of her works to be played at the Proms. A BBC commission, Benjamin Grosvenor, will give the piece its premiere this lunchtime. Three other Proms firsts ahead. First complete performance of Monpeau's Landscapes, first performance of the piano version of Ravel's Valse Noble et Sentimental, and first performance of Liszt's transcription of the waltz from Gounod's Faust. To begin, one of the pinnacles of the piano repertoire, the work that inspired a year of study by one of our national newspaper editors, and a book, the title of which tells us much, The Amateur Against the Impossible. Well, the piece that that newspaper editor found so difficult was Chopin's G minor ballade. To play it for us today, please welcome Benjamin Grosvenor.
Thank you.